This is KUOW's The Record. Welcome, I'm Bill Radke. The Seattle resident you're about to meet now loves airplane travel, and he loves mysteries. Those are big reasons Blaine Allen Gibson is trying to solve one of the biggest aviation mysteries ever. Why Malaysian Air Flight 370 and everyone on board seemed to just disappear off radars over the Gulf of Thailand in 2014. Now, a love of flight and mystery does not make you an expert. And airplane crash experts from all over the world are investigating Malaysian Air 370. So I asked Gibson, what makes you qualified to solve this mystery?
Well, my sources and qualifications are that I'm willing to look at this with an open mind and think outside of the box to try to go find out what happened.
This is not your first mystery.
No, it's not my first mystery, but it's my first mystery that has to do with a missing plane.
What other mysteries have you pursued?
I worked on some archaeological expeditions to try to discover what happened to the Maya in Guatemala and Belize.
The Mayan civilization?
The Mayan civilization. I went to the epicenter of the Tunguska meteorite in Siberia. I was the second American ever to go in there to try to figure out what that was. And I went looking for the lost Ark of the Covenant in Ethiopia. So I've...
How'd that go?
Well, I didn't find it, but I think I know about where it is.
And why did you decide you needed to unravel the mystery of Malaysian Air Flight 370?
Well, this combines a lot of the things that really interest me. Aviation, science, physics, oceanography. I fly a lot. And also geopolitics and law, because there are a lot of different countries and interests involved in this search. And so after starting to read and learn about it, I went to the one-year commemoration and met a lot of the family members. And that gave me an extra inspiration to try to solve this mystery, because it's not just like I'm trying to figure out what happened to an old civilization. I am trying to find out what happened to these people. I cannot imagine, even though they've told me, how these families feel. Absolutely no contact at all, no information whatsoever on what happened to their loved ones for almost 2.5 years.
What do you remember about finding out about the downing of that plane that day, and what clicked for you that said, I'm on this?
What really clicked for me was when I found out that it didn't just disappear off the civilian radar and crash in the Gulf of Thailand, that it actually crossed back over into the Straits of Malacca, up towards the Andaman Sea, and then disappeared off the military radar, and yet, according to the Inmarsat data, flew on for about 7 hours. And there's never been anything really quite like that. With all the other plane crashes, we've known where they crashed. We really don't know where this crashed, and the only real clue we have is the Inmarsat satellite data and its interpretation, and some eyewitness accounts, some of which are consistent with it and some of which conflict with it.
One of the things that fascinates me about you and your story is the community of people out there who you've tapped,
yes,
who have different, the civilians and formers who you've tapped and put on your team. What kind of specialists have you collected on Facebook and elsewhere?
Private citizens like myself who are very interested in solving this mystery, one, because they also love solving mysteries and love aviation, and two, because they want to bring answers to the families. These are concerned private citizens doing it out of good motivations to try to get answers. Some of them are specialists in engineering who understand the satellites. Some are pilots who can understand the fuel calculations. Others are simply good at Googling and looking for plane parts and telling me if something is part of a plane. And others are very good with politics and things like that to try to understand who might be behind some of the information and disinformation efforts going out there. So it's been very interesting. I've got a great group of people.
From the Seattle area, some of them?
They're from all over the world, from England, from Australia, from Indonesia.
What did it feel like to find that first piece of debris from that plane?
When I saw it, I knew it was from a plane because it had no step written on it. the press asked me if I was happy. And the answer is no. Happy would have been if I had landed on that sandbank and found 239 people grilling shrimp and sipping on coconuts saying, "What took you so long?" That's happy. But we want to find the truth, whatever it is. And what I had hoped to find were some clues that would lead us to that truth. And the no-step panel that I found showed that at least the tail shattered on impact. And what was really good from the no-step panel was that after the press coverage of that came out, other people started to look and find things. A teenager in South Africa said, "Oh, I saw one of those. I saw it on a beach in Mozambique. I picked it up and brought it home." So there's a second piece. An archaeologist found a piece in South Africa. A couple found a piece of cabin debris in Rodriguez, and they all said that they only recognized it because of the press coverage of what I had found. So that is very good.
Blaine, you say the Malaysian Air Flight 370 mystery must be solved.
Yes.
Why must it be solved?
For one thing, we owe it to the families to give them answers of what happened to their loved ones. And the flying public feels that way. Imagine when you get on a plane, if you think that this plane could just disappear and my loved ones could never, ever know what happened to me. That is a torture that to me is unimaginable. So for the families themselves, we owe it to them to give them answers, but also for the flying public. People need to know that they're not going to just disappear. Maybe there'll be a crash, maybe there'll be a tragedy, but we'll always be able to find out what happened and why.
How much money have you spent on this?
I don't add it up, and the reason I don't is that I love traveling. And for example, when I went to Mozambique, it was because I've had the goal to go to every country in the world since I was 7 years old, and Mozambique was one I'd never been to. But while I was there, knowing the currents and drift, I thought, well, I might find some piece of Malaysia 370 here. So I chartered a boat for $240. I had asked around local boatmen and fishermen, where do things tend to wash ashore? This is Africa. People beachcomb and collect things that they can use. The boatman told me, Junior from Dolphin Dhow Safaris, that the Paluma Sandbank is a place where fishermen go to get buoys and nets and things they can use. So I said, let's go there. We walked around on the Paluma Sandbank, and it was mostly just regular beach junk. And then suddenly, Junior picks up and is holding this light gray triangular-shaped panel, and I walk towards it, and it says no step on it. And I just thought, wow, this is it.
Amazing. So you've incorporated this mystery, this obsession, if you will, into your life of travel. You're on the Paluma Sandbank in Mozambique.
It's not an obsession. It is a mission.
A mission.
It is a quest.
At what point do you decide it's not worth searching anymore? You give up.
When I or someone else finds the plane and, most important, what happened to it and what happened to the passengers.
But that could be years away, if ever.
It could be.
You'll never give up?
No, I'm not going to give up. I'm going to keep trying. And like I said, this is not an obsession. This is a mission. I have another life. I do other things. But until this mystery is solved, I am not going to stop trying to solve it and looking for it.
And if someone else, after all you've been through, if someone else solves the mystery before you, how would you feel?
Absolutely wonderful. I would be very happy that the mystery is solved. I would immediately want to meet them, congratulate them, and buy them a beer. This is not a competition. We're all looking for the truth. And if someone does it, wonderful. I embrace it.
Blaine Allen Gibson of Seattle is trying to find out what happened to Malaysian Air Flight 370. On March 8, 2014, the plane was flying over the Gulf of Thailand when it disappeared. The plane crashed, but nobody knows why. Yesterday, The Guardian reported that one well-known crash expert says it must have been a rogue pilot who brought the plane down on purpose. Just one of the theories. We're tweeting a link to that story from The Guardian right now. At KUOW. Meanwhile, one of the great airplanes of all time might be on the way out. What would it mean for Boeing to phase out the 747? That's coming up in 15 minutes on KUOW's The Record. KUOW 94.9 FM, Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. Does this presidential campaign seem especially uncivil to you?
A small, insecure money grubber.
She's a goofus. She is a goofus. I mean, this woman, she's a basket case.
Donald Trump and Senator Elizabeth Warren attacking each other there. Professor Cornell Clayton teaches government at Washington State University. He says, yeah, our politics are pretty divided right now, but that's not new.
Andrew Jackson was often referred to as Andrew Jackass or Andrew Dumbass, so much so that he eventually adopted the moniker for himself, which is why the Democratic Party to this day is represented by the donkey.
Professor Clayton says politics have been rough for a long time, and they are now, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
These are all periods when we have very deep divisions in our society, and that's what's driving the incivility. Our politics becomes more passionate when our politics matters more. And our society is deeply divided today, and our political parties are highly polarized. And that means that our politics means a lot more today. That's why people become so passionate, and that's why you get incivility.
Well, let's define incivility, because that's pretty fraught right there. I mean, are we saying that a raucous protest is uncivil, or that politicians calling out their enemies is uncivil? You could see how defining what's uncivil in itself is kind of aggressive. You know
sure.
what I mean?
And I think the common way to think about incivility is that it's simply violating the traditional norms, customs, and conventions of behavior for a particular institutional setting. And so, you know, incivility, you can say things that are truthful and still be uncivil in the way you express them. You can say things that are untruthful and not be uncivil necessarily in the way you're doing it. So civility has nothing to do with truth, the truth content of your statements. It also is not necessarily related to democracy. I think a lot of people think that in order for democracy to function, we must have a very high level of civil discourse. And it's certainly true that there are certain forms of civility that are required in a democracy, but not all acts of incivility are by nature undemocratic. I'll just give you a couple of examples. You take, for instance, the women suffragettes in the 1920s. They were considered uncivil merely for speaking out publicly at a time when women were not supposed to be speaking publicly about politics. And yet we think of them today as actually not only undemocratic, we think of them as actually advancing the democratic cause by pressing their claims for democratic inclusion. Same thing with the modern civil rights protesters in the 1960s. Many of their acts were considered uncivil. For instance, the black athletes who raised a fist at the Olympics, or the civil rights protesters who desegregated lunch counters. They were certainly violating the norms and customs of and even the laws of Southern society. But we think of those acts as actually advancing democracy, not as a threat to democracy. So there are acts that are uncivil, that are undemocratic. So obviously acts of violence, threats, intimidation, acts that try to exclude people from being involved in democratic discourse, those are all undemocratic acts of incivility. But I think it's important to separate out, what is undemocratic from what is uncivil.
So you're saying there's been more incivility in the American past, but you do think we are very politically polarized right now? What do you mean, and what's the difference?
There have been past periods of deep, deep incivility in our politics. And what's happened over the last 30 to 40 years is we have sorted ourselves ideologically into these tribal-like parties. And what that has led to is affective polarization. It's led us to distrust and to actually start to loathe each other. And that is a much more emotional response rather than an intellectual response or even an ideological response. And it doesn't matter what facts you throw out at each other. We're not going to convince the other side, because this is really much more about emotionally how each side feels and how they feel about the other side and what the other side's doing or wants to do to this country.
What can I do to advance civility, but as you say, still try to get something done that maybe somebody else would rather I shut up about?
The question is whether our goal is to be civil for civility's sake or whether our goal is to actually have our democracy function and operate. Democratic politics is oftentimes it's about division. It's about competing views about where our nation ought to go. Now, oftentimes that discussion and debate, the natural byproduct of it is conflict and passion and heat. And sometimes that will lead to incivility. That concerns me much less, that style of discourse, than the actual issues that are dividing us. So one way, I think, to think about incivility in politics is to think about what it is, what are the issues that are actually dividing us? And let's focus on what those issues are, as opposed to whether somebody's called me a name or not, or whether or not someone's said you're stupid or you know, you're ignorant. It's much more important that we focus on the actual issues dividing our society today than the style of our discourse, I think.
Would you call Donald Trump uncivil?
Certainly. I mean, I think he's challenged almost every norm and convention of political behavior that we know. You know, the type of name calling he's engaged in. So he's certainly uncivil. I would also, my own personal view is he's also has some positions that I think are problematic from a democratic standpoint in terms of his view about who should be included in American democracy and whose voices should count and how we think about our fellow citizens. And that concerns me more than his name calling, to tell you the truth.
And yet Trump's millions of supporters might argue that he is being civil. He may be rude or coarse, but that I assume they don't go around thinking that he's uncivil and so are they.
I think that many of them actually recognize that he's violating the traditions and norms and conventions of acceptable behavior. In fact, I think many of them revel in that and say that he's not politically correct, that he's telling it like it is.
So maybe millions of Americans disagree that incivility is a problem.
I think that is the case. I mean, I think people oftentimes in a highly polarized political system like ours is today, they see incivility on the other side. They don't see it so much on their own side. Or if they see it, they can justify it as simply telling the truth.
So part of your takeaway is to listeners might be ease up on the civility police, being the civility police. That's not our biggest problem.
Well, I think it's oftentimes a distraction. Now, again, I think from a standpoint of leadership and from a personal level, I think being civil to each other is a great virtue. I think our political leaders ought to display civility because I think it's a mark of character. But I think that's different from the question of whether or not all acts of incivility threaten our democracy. And oftentimes it is the case that incivility can advance democracy in certain ways. Certain forms of incivility are always undemocratic, you know, violence, threats, intimidation. But other forms of incivility, you know, simply name calling, it's simply the byproduct of the give and take of democratic politics.
Professor Cornell Clayton is director of the Thomas S. Foley Institute of Public Policy and Public Service at Washington State University. Today, Donald Trump is campaigning in Ohio and Pennsylvania as his war of words continues with the Muslim parents of a fallen army captain. More to hear about that today on KUOW's All Things Considered. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. It's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle is a city that loves rules. We wear our helmets, we use our crosswalks, and of course we honk only in case of an emergency. So, it was fitting that we got this question from one of our local Wonder listeners.
My name is Isaac Chirino. I live in the Shoreline area, and I've been wondering which way pedestrians and bicyclists are really supposed to go around Green Lake.
Right. What's really the right way to go around Green Lake? We set out KUOW's Isolde Raftery to find the answer.
The answer to your question, Isaac of Shoreline, is simple. There's a 3-mile path that goes around Green Lake. It has two lanes, wheels, you get the outside lane, and please go counterclockwise. Feet, stay in the lane closest to the lake. Walk either way, we don't care, but quit veering into the wheels lane. That's it. Easy. But 25 years ago, things were not so straightforward. Robin Hennis remembers it well.
Starting in 1991, soon after I bought a house in the Green Lake neighborhood, I started walking to work around the lake.
Green Lake is the busiest park in Seattle. There are 2 boathouses, a theater, and an amusing cast of characters that walks around the lake. Like those old school rollerbladers and the gentleman who wears a vest offering Spanish lessons. But at 6:30 in the morning, which is when Robin would walk to work, the park was still so quiet.
Each morning I would encounter a couple of women who would tell me that I was walking the wrong way.
Seattle nice, they were not.
Wrong way!
They would say, wrong way, and then it turned into wrong way, lady.
You're going the wrong way, lady!
And then it got kind of snarly and it would be,
can't read, stupid lady! What's the matter with you? Can't find a man?
And then it just got weird.
Then they would do odd things like pop out of shrubbery and say, there she is! And they started taking my picture every day. And then they videotaped me, and they would videotape me talking to people so that they would threaten other people who had any contact with me. Then they started shaking a fistful of keys at me, and then they blasted me with a whistle.
A bear whistle. It was so loud that once Robin lost her balance. The woman who blew that whistle, her name is Carolyn Frost. I tracked her down, but she didn't want to be recorded. She's in her 70s now. When she was patrolling Green Lake, she was a middle-aged mom of 3. And she told me that she was the one being harassed. See, there were these runners, and they would charge at her and her friend and yell, "Trail!" So the 2 moms decided to fight back. They targeted anyone they thought was going the wrong way, including the runners, Robin, and an 80-year-old woman. Eventually, Robin and 5 others banded together. They asked a judge for a temporary restraining order, and they got it. Carolyn Frost and her friend were banned from the lake for 3 months. The next year, city officials said they would improve the path. One of the reasons they gave, conflicts at the park.
When we rebuilt the trail, we tried to be very intentional about posting the rules and large attractive signs that people could instantly get reminded of what the general directions were.
That's Holly Miller. She was Seattle's park superintendent at the time. She says that Green Lake has never had park rangers, which means parkgoers must police each other. A friendly comment usually does the trick. But she says some people take the job a little too seriously. She doesn't really know why.
Because somebody's feeling like they have a little OCD and they need to get everybody going in the same direction so they feel okay. Or whatever motivates people to do that, I don't know.
You hit that dude!
He was in right in the middle of the lane. I had no options.
That's Matthew Stribe. He zips around Green Lake twice a week, usually in his old roller derby skates.
I seem like a jerk when I'm trying to get people to follow the rules, but there's no other way to do it. And the Parks Department basically is telling me, okay, you have to do it if you want the rules to be followed.
Matthew feels some kinship with those 2 women from the early 1990s, but he says he would never use a bear whistle. He's not the only bossy person at Green Lake. There's also an older woman in a pink tracksuit who yells, "Wrong way!" And all those people who shout, "On your right!" to the rest of us slowpokes. So back to Isaac from Shoreline. Which way to go around Green Lake? I would say he shouldn't worry about the right way, because someone there will surely let him know. From Green Lake in Seattle, I'm Isolde Raftery for KUOW's Local Wonder.
That story was inspired. And it was inspired by a question from a listener, Isaac Chirino. And we've been hearing from you about this one on Facebook. Our social media producer, Kara McDermott, what are our listeners saying?
Well, there's a lot of passion on the topic. Ryan said, on wheels, anything other than counterclockwise is downright villainous and should be responded to with withering looks of shame and derision. That's that Seattle vocabulary coming out.
Yeah.
Maria said, I'm torn. I've been schooled both on feet and bikes. Should we yell? Should we whistle? Should we just mind our own business and just avoid it?
Right. Is it a courtesy to say on your right? Are you being overdoing it?
It's the Seattle freeze.
Yeah.
Right back at us. And then Kimberly said, stroller moms two abreast was my version of a runner's hell. I don't even do Green Lake anymore.
Well, now you can set people straight. You can tell that Green Lake rule breaker that KOW told you. It goes wheels counterclockwise on the outside lane, feet either way, just stay in your inside lane. And you can hear more stories from our Local Wonder series at KOW.org. And while you're there, leave us your local wonder. What do you want to know about the Puget Sound region? If your question gets picked, then a KUOW reporter is going to hunt it down. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Boeing's iconic 747 jumbo jet has been coming off the Boeing assembly lines for almost 50 years. But lately, 747 production has sunk from one per month to one every other month. And now, Boeing says in a regulatory filing that, quote, it is reasonably possible that we could decide to end production of the 747. Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton has written a lot about these planes, but his connection to the 747 started decades ago when he was a young boy in Phoenix. He heard a sound and he looked up.
And I saw this enormous jet flying low over the neighborhood, making its approach to the airport. I'd never seen anything that big. And my friends and I were just mesmerized at the size of the thing. And I was enough of a little nerd that I knew what it was. I'd just never seen one before. And that it could be in the sky so gracefully, just floating in seemingly, was amazing.
Yeah, graceful, even though it's gigantic. The plane, and with a hump, by the way. I saw a British headline, "The plane with a hump heads for the dump."
Right. Not quite the dump. It's going to be around for a long time, even if they don't make it.
Right. The planes are still there. Before we move on from that, by the way, what is in the hump?
Well, it depends on the airplane. In the early ones, it was a lounge with a very elegant spiral staircase going to it. In others, it can be seating. In the freighter, it may have certain equipment and extra seating. It just depends on the model.
And why would Boeing quit making the 747?
Well, because demand has changed. Airlines want to make different kinds of routes than they did when the 747 was initially designed. Nowadays, they tend to prefer twin-engine jets, even for wide bodies. They want more fuel economy. They want less of a footprint in greenhouse gases. And those can be much more efficient and cost-efficient. And then they also have the hub-and-spoke system that they didn't have in 1970-71. And so for all these reasons, demand has changed. So the huge double-decker Airbus plane is hardly selling at all. And that's the dilemma that Boeing faces.
What does all of this mean for me as an air traveler?
Well, for you as an air traveler, you may have fewer options to experience the particular magic of flying in a 747. Otherwise, as a traveler, it's probably not going to mean much.
I had never been in the hump anyway.
We do have 2,000 people on the line in Everett, and so if they do stop production, that means potentially fewer jobs here. Not necessarily, but potentially.
Why only potentially? What?
Well, we're ramping up for the 777X, and there may be another plane coming along down the pike. So employment here has always gone up and down. Right now it's slightly going down. But those 2,000 people on the line with the 747 will need to go somewhere.
What are the odds Boeing would live to someday regret dumping the hump if they did?
Well, you never know. There's a story that at one point years ago, they became so efficient on one of the assembly lines for the 747 that they shut down the other one. And then they so regretted missing that second wide body assembly line, it could have helped with the 787. So you just can't tell the future. But right now, the economics of it are just not working in Boeing's favor.
John, any final thoughts on the enormous yet somehow graceful 747?
Well, this was a plane that very much defined Boeing's reinvention of itself. It defined many of Boeing's either leaps forward or engineering come-to-God moments to continue making these kind of enormous planes. And it will always be one of the most iconic airplanes that's associated with Boeing, just like the B-52 or the B-29, maybe even someday the 787.
Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton on the future, the questionable future of the 747. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Bill.
And you're listening to KUOW's The Record. One of the top news stories today, mosquitoes have infected at least 10 more people in Miami with the Zika virus. And the Centers for Disease Control now say pregnant women should avoid a small section of that city. Florida's Governor Rick Scott says one way to prevent the spread of Zika has to do with where mosquitoes breed.
Biggest thing is no standing water, no standing water. And then no standing water, and then no standing water. If everybody would get rid of their standing water, use bug repellent, use protective gear, then what the mosquito boards are going to be doing and continue to do around the state, we will be successful.
That is what life is like in the other corner of America. There have been 14 Zika infections now in Florida. The CDC says men and women who have been in that affected area of Miami since June 15th should wait at least 8 weeks before trying to conceive a child. Infection during pregnancy can cause babies to be born with defects. You'll hear more details about this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Thank you for joining us on KUOW today. I'm Bill Radke. 10 years ago, the afternoon of July 28th, 2006, it was hot, sunny, lovely Seattle summer day. Late that afternoon, a gunman shattered the calm when he entered the offices of the Jewish Federation of Greater Seattle and opened fire. One woman died. Several others were wounded, including Cheryl Stumbo. Last year, Stumbo told Marcy Silman what that day was like and why she still talks about it as much as she can.
Things were winding down. Some people had left early. So the office was pretty quiet. And I was basically just sitting there waiting for my niece to arrive. My 14-year-old niece, who lives in Oregon, was visiting me for a week.
When did you know something was wrong?
I heard a stranger's voice, a strange man's voice, coming from the reception area, which was just a couple of doors down from my office. And that was very unusual. We didn't have strangers show up, and we had a secure building, and much less an angry male voice was very unusual. So it was within seconds of hearing that voice, and it was getting louder and angrier, and I stood up to go see if I could help.
When you went out to help, what kind of emotions were going through your mind?
I don't know if I was even having emotions. I stepped to my door of my office to look down towards the reception area, and I was confused. I couldn't figure out what was going on.
What did you do?
I was shocked. I mean, I was just looking at this man who's holding the gun up at, you know, chest height, waving it around and shouting these angry words. And my brain was trying to figure out what's going on and how do I solve this problem and what? Why are you here? And it was so out of the blue and the last thing I would expect. I mean, I think we all kind of go through in our head, you know, rehearsing for emergencies. Like, what if I'm on the viaduct and there's an earthquake? What would I do in my car? Or, you know, what if somebody broke into my house? What would I do? You kind of rehearse these scenarios. This was one scenario that it had never occurred to me what happened. I ran through all the possibilities and came to only one that could actually happen.
What was that option?
That was to call out as loud as I could, call 911. Because I was standing in the hallway. I didn't have a phone within reach of me, and that was the only thing I could think of.
Where was your niece? Had she arrived?
I didn't know it at the time, but that was how he got in the building, was holding the gun to her head down at the street level. And that's how they got buzzed through, was he said, "You'll get me through or I'll kill you." And then he followed her up the stairs holding the gun to her. head. And when they got to the reception desk and he started interacting with the receptionist, Kelsey, my niece, noticed that he was distracted, and she just kept walking quietly and then walked down the hall and locked herself in a stall in the ladies' room.
So you called out to whoever would be able to do this, call 911, and then what happened?
He started shooting immediately, and he just went around in a circle and just fired. Yeah, I felt what at the time I thought he reached out and punched me. I mean, he was standing right next to me, and I thought that he reached out with the gun in his hand and punched me in my side. It turns out that that was actually when I was shot, and so I deliberately fell to the floor and put my arms over my head. I was on my stomach and was just waiting. I just figured, this is it. Here comes the shot that's going to kill me.
I'm talking with Cheryl Stumbo, and she was one of the women who were shot in 2006 at the Jewish Federation offices in downtown Seattle. How serious was that injury?
It was very serious. He shot me at point-blank range in the abdomen with a hollow-point bullet, which... those explode as they hit soft tissue. So it tore through my small and large intestines and my uterus.
How long did you stay in the hospital?
I was at Harborview for 6 weeks. Yeah. Went through about 10 surgeries during those 6 weeks, including major lung surgery because the abdomen wound threw off a clot that went to my lung and collapsed it.
So you were marketing communications for a nonprofit organization. Did you think of yourself as a political activist at that point?
No. I think the most I'd ever done was had a bumper sticker and voted in every election. That was it. I didn't even know anything about our state government. I didn't know that I had two reps and a state senator. I didn't know anything.
When did you first started speaking out publicly for gun control?
I actually had tried for several years after the trial was over and everything. I wanted my old life back. So I was trying to put everything behind me and not have it be the center of my life. Mm. I just wanted my old life back. And I tried that for a few years, and it wasn't working. This had changed me. It was just 2 years ago, this past November, I finally made the decision, okay, I'm gonna do something. I don't know what yet, but I'm going to raise my hand and say I want to speak out about this.
Was there something particular that pushed you to that decision?
Between my shooting and that point, all these other mass shootings were happening around the country. You know, Virginia Tech and Tucson and Aurora Theater, and then the Clackamas Mall shooting in Oregon. And I think it was that combination, that series of shootings, and me seeing them on the news and having this emotional reaction to it, and then the world just going back to normal, everyone just forgetting about it until the next shooting happened. And I just thought, this can't be normal. This can't be the new normal. I feel like I have to do something just so that for my own sake, I feel like I'm doing something about it. A couple of weeks after I had finally made that decision that I was going to try and do something, Sandy Hook happened. And, you know, a whole lot of people had a wake-up call. And so a few folks in the media who had covered the trial and my shooting, I let them know I'm going to try and, you know, be talking about this. If you want to talk to a local gun violence victim for perspective on Sandy Hook, I'm available. And that got the ball rolling.
And then the ball really started rolling. You were a citizen sponsor of Initiative 594, which is the gun background check measure that voters approved in November of 2014. Describe to me your feelings on election night when you knew that this had been approved.
I have never felt anything like that before. I've never given birth, but I imagine that that's what it might feel like, that you've worked so hard and you're so exhausted, but you're so elated at the result.
You've talked about this. You've made gun control and gun safety your career at this point.
Right now, yeah.
Right now it is what you do. It seems like so much of your life has changed since that scary afternoon in 2006, and yet it kind of revolves around what happened.
Yeah.
I'm curious what it's like to spend so much of your time having to relive what was really awful.
Well, part of what you learn in PTSD therapy is that you train your brain so you're not reliving it. You're just sharing the story. So it's a memory, not a reliving.
How do you do that?
Well, it's cognitive behavioral therapy. You're retraining your brain to put the memory in the right place in your brain so that it's in a memory slot, not in a current event slot.
What does that day July 28th, I think it was.
July 28th, 2006.
When I say that date, what does that mean to you?
It probably is like when you say September 11th, 2001 to somebody. It's a major event in my life. It was a negative event, but it is a memory now. I don't experience the actual event over and over again when I share my story.
Cheryl Stumbo was wounded in the 2006 gun attack on the Jewish Federation of Seattle. One woman died. Several were wounded. The shooter blamed his mental illness and the lack of treatment. He apologized for the attack. He said, "From the depth of my being," he was sentenced to life in prison. Cheryl Stumbo spoke last year with KUOW's Marcy Silman. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We did it, Seattle. According to a marketing data firm, we beat out Portland when it comes to having the most hipsters. Do we still call people hipsters? Does anyone want to be called a hipster? I asked Cal McAllister. He's executive creative director of the Seattle marketing agency Wexley School for Girls. He told me what it means to be a hipster in Seattle.
You see one on the street on their fixie bikes and their big spacer earrings, and I think that we have a bunch of hipsters that work with us at Wexley, at the agency. So
you do. You have a bunch of hipsters. You call them that.
Hipsters. Yeah, they call themselves that.
Really?
But I think in this day and age, it's more self-deprecating than anything.
Right. Yeah. That's what I want to get at. How did it become? So what was hipster originally, and how did it become self-deprecating?
You know, I think that hipster sort of came out of the steampunk movement, where people would use machinery to make things complicated that were really fairly simple, like 15-piece pipes for tobacco smoke and glass fixtures made out of light bulbs when one light bulb would do.
Yes.
I think that hipsters sort of came around and came out of that movement where there's a lot of focus on execution and pride in execution. And that could be whether you're making a latte or poaching an egg, or even doing a show poster, a rock and roll poster on a screen print press. I think there's a lot of attention to detail and focus. And then they start to identify, I think hipsters started to identify themselves with old flannel and handlebar mustaches, and that's where some of the visual cues came out.
So I was surprised in 2016 to hear a report coming out, you know, to hear that apparently people are competing to, cities would be competing to say they have a bunch of hipsters, because didn't that term long ago become, well, you said it, it's not a compliment anymore, right? I think smug, I think ironic and self-congratulatory.
Yeah, I think it's derogatory. If you look in some of the reviews, I was reading some of the different restaurant reviews of The Stranger that The Stranger puts out, and some of the more indie press comments, they always say, if you can get past the hipster element, if you can forgive the hipster piece of it, and I think that just is part of the vernacular now, because it was maybe cool 5 or 6 years ago, and now it's not painted with such a bright brush.
And what's behind that? What's wrong with being a hipster?
I think that it's just become cliche, and I think even some of the hipster community will say when people start to emulate you, it loses a little bit of its excitement.
This marketing data company looked at the number of independent coffee shops, tattoo parlors, thrift stores, and record shops per population.
Take that, Portland. You can have your NBA team and your MLS championship, but we are hoisting the True Cup, the winners of the big data hipster competition.
Yes, we by that definition, we had more hipsters than Portland. Who would use a report like this?
You know, I think that this report was probably done just in someone's spare time. I think that big data companies have big data and they can plug in a bunch of factors. Portland did come in second to us, and the report said the difference was the number of our independent coffee shops. But I think that's what's sort of interesting about big data, and where there's a little bit of danger. You can't actually lie with the numbers, but you can add what you want to manipulate it to mean what you want. And if I were marketing to hipsters, I would certainly go to Portland, where there's a bigger concentration, than come to Seattle. And that's where these reports are kind of deceiving.
Who's marketing to hipsters?
Oh, probably Brussels sprout growers on Vashon Island and small goat farms where they can where you can come and do your own butchery. I think hipsters, more seriously in the broader market, are into they're into appearance, and so there are beard balms, and they'll spend more money on a haircut and more money on a latte. They're actually fairly brand. They're fairly brand aware, not necessarily big brand, but they like to be the mavens in a Malcolm Gladwell way and expose new and interesting things and support their friends, you know, and they'll wear silkscreen T-shirts and they like to be identified. So I don't know that big companies are marketing to them, but there is definitely a market there. They have expendable income.
I guess everybody becomes brand identified eventually.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel indie or hip or admirable. It's just like, well, okay, like everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah, you've been segmented. Somehow the odd bedfellows of taxidermy and veganism have put you in a category all on your own, and you are now a market.
So whether Seattle is hipster or not, where do you think Seattle is on the hipster, indie? You know, if we're not hipster, what are we? What's your take on this?
Yeah, that's, you know, that's interesting. I think that one of the things that I've always loved about Seattle is this town is very, very supportive of people's individual and independent endeavors. And I think that that's natural in what historically has been the hipster community or the indie rock community or the grunge community. And I think that Seattle, like no place else I've ever lived, really supports and has the economy to support restaurants and T-shirt shops and some of the things that are sort of cast in that light. But this town has just been really terrific and continues to be in supporting the arts and culture, at least at the independent level. We could do better in the school level.
So hipsters aren't beloved if they ever were, but there's something about that Seattle spirit that you do love.
I do. And I think that the thing about that Seattle spirit that I do love is just how supportive this town can be. And even if you look down your nose at the 23-year-old on his fixie, I think you do appreciate that this town will let you present yourself as what you want to be and as independent, and sleeves of tattoos on really nice babysitters. You know, it's an unusual combination, but this town is really supportive of it.
Are we all hipsters now?
You know what? I think even if we want to duck it, I think we all are hipsters now. I think that now that we've been cast and we'll hold that scarf high above our heads, Seattle is the hipster city. We should be proud of it. We should make our own shoes if we wear them at all. And we should probably look for third and fourth generation shirts at overpriced secondhand shops. I mean, it's time to celebrate.
Bring in the hipster irony. That's Cal McAllister, co-founder and executive creative director of the Seattle marketing agency Wexley School for Girls. If you want to read that marketing study that names Seattle the most hipster city in America, have at it. We're tweeting a link to the study now at KUOW. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you've tuned in. The political conventions just ended. Election Day is 3 months away, but we just heard that the White House has started preparing to hand over power to either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. How do you prepare for that ambiguous handoff? You'll find out this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. We keep hearing that a big reason this election is even close is that some people don't like Hillary Clinton. They find her unrelatable or untrustworthy. Our social media producer, Kara McDermott, is here. Kara, you heard from a listener who questions that story.
Yes. This Seattle listener wants us to stop and ask where we're getting our political narratives.
I just wonder how much of the aversion to Hillary Clinton is real on any concrete fact or act that she may or may not have done, and how much of it is just a, you know, a long-term character assassination of her husband that came out of the fevered imagination of Roger Ailes or Frank Luntz or Karl Rove or the Koch brothers.
So that's
I look at my own perception of her, and I really can't tell. You know, it's hard to tell sometimes. But she, like Al Gore, I think, is more sinned against than sinning in this matter.
So that's Gar in Seattle. Thank you for calling, and I'm sorry if I cut you off a bit. Our phone number is 206-221-3663 if you want to bring in your own opinions.
Right. I like to hear people questioning the narrative. Like, wait a minute. Everybody says that we feel this way. Is that really true? Thank you, Gar. And we also are live tweeting the show right now. We'd like to hear from you on Twitter at KUOW. And you know about our Facebook page. Thanks for tuning in today to The Record on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle News and Information.